so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Welcome into Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. On today's show, one of the world's greatest storytellers, how a phone call 45 years ago simply to say, I admire your work, led to my own 45-year media career. We'll also meet a woman whose life is defined by an endless appetite for adventure that was fueled by family road trips back in the 1940s. And in a GB classic flashback, we'll hear from the legendary Diane Carroll, the very first African-American actress to star in her own TV series. You know, one of the keys to happy and healthy longevity is the ability to continue growing and adapting and reinventing. And truth be told, it's really more of a willingness than it is an ability, because that ability does reside in all of us. It's part of human nature. It's baked in because it's important to our individual survival. Life is about evolution, and not just for the species, but as individuals. But few of us, as we get older, exercise that ability. And you've got to wonder, is it because we don't know that we have it? Is it because we're afraid? Is it because our culture tells us it's not possible because family and friends don't encourage us? You know, I think it's probably a good bit of everything. And when you get right down to it, that is pretty much why Growing Bolder exists. We want to be the voice that reminds you of your abilities and of the opportunities. We're the voice that tells you that it is possible, so go for it. And the way we do that is by telling stories, by sharing the wisdom and the words and the relatable examples of others who have found their own way to keep moving forward as they get older. And I had a catch-up call with an old friend recently that reminded me about the excitement, about the power, about the benefit of self-expression. The example and inspiration of this friend and his willingness to help me is really largely responsible for my 45-year career in the media. I was a swimming coach back in the day in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I started to watch a local news station in Phoenix, and I immediately became fascinated by the sports anchor at this station. This is a guy who didn't just break the mold of the typical sportscaster, he totally shattered it. He was unlike anybody I had ever seen on television, and this was pre-email. So one day I actually called the station. Somehow I got through to him, and I told him, I don't really have an ask. I was only calling to say that I admire your unique point of view, and I'm in awe of your features, your creativity, because you've got to be fearless to be creative. It's all about taking chances. I just wanted to encourage this guy. But he invited me to the station, and we became fast friends, and I learned then that he'd never worked a single day in television until he was 31 years old. And the way that he got into television is he would lug an old 8mm movie projector from the office of one television executive to the other, and he would project his home movies that he had imagined and edited onto the walls, looking for a job as a reporter. And one after another, they all told him that he was unqualified. They said, you're too old, you're inexperienced, and oh yeah, you don't have the right look. You will never get a job in television. But this is a guy who persisted. And finally, against all odds, he did talk his way into a part-time job that was paying him about $40 a week. And this is a 31-year-old married guy that had a couple of kids. Now, I had never even considered working in television before this, but his example made me realize, you know, why not? It's possible. I realized I didn't need a degree in broadcast journalism. And with this guy's help, with his encouragement, I put together an audition tape. I pretended to be a freelance reporter in a major market, Phoenix, Arizona, and I very quickly got a job in a small market that led to a 30-year on-air career and ultimately to becoming the founder of Growing Bolder. And I was not the only one that was blown away by this guy's storytelling ability. Within a year of landing that first part-time job, he was the main sports anchor on the CBS station in Phoenix. And a few months after that, The vice chairman of NBC was in Phoenix one night. He saw just one of his sports stories and offered him a job on the Today Show, which he accepted and he held for decades. Mike Leonard was the first television network correspondent to research, to produce, to shoot, to write, and to edit all of his own stories. I mean, this is the guy who pioneered the new broadcast journalism model that has literally changed the way the industry operates worldwide. Mike is a multiple Emmy Award-winning reporter and producer. He's a celebrated filmmaker. He's a New York Times best-selling author whose lifelong quest has been to share stories of ordinary people and to celebrate common humanity. And on a recent catch-up call, I knew that I had to get Mike on this show when he shared with me that now at the age of 76, he feels like he's 19 because of his excitement over a new media project that not only is providing an outlet for his remarkable talent, but an opportunity to reconnect with the countless viewers and readers who followed him for years. An opportunity to also reach and now connect with a new generation who will very soon learn what makes Mike Leonard special. As you will right now, because Mike Leonard is going to join us from his home outside of suburban Chicago. Mike, how you doing today?
Mark, that's the best intro I've ever heard, man. I should thought the check will be arriving in the mail.
Well, thank you for enduring why I did it. And, you know, I didn't have to write it. I just have to remember it. You've been a good friend for many, many years, an inspiration to so many. And before we get into your new adventure, tell us a little bit about life in Chicago as a 76-year-old grandfather. I mean, how do you spend your days? And I'm guessing that as active as I know you are, you had to feel like something was missing, even given all that you have.
That's very true. I've always worked out of my house. Well, not always. Maybe after the first 7 or 8 years at NBC, I cut a deal where I could be by myself. And having four kids growing up, I wanted to be part of their lives. And so it was really terrific. You have to be self-disciplined. You have to do the work and all the rest. But I love the freedom. And as you know, when you ask for freedom, you ask for responsibility too. So NBC gave me the freedom to pick my own stories. And I've loved that. Did over 1,000 stories at NBC, and most of them, almost all of them, of my choosings. Occasionally they would say, can you go to the Olympics or can you go to the Super Bowl or the Golden Globes or something? But do whatever you want when you get there. And I love that. And I always would go without a story, a bit of a desperation situation. And I would always find one. And it would air, and people there would say, geez, that was great. Where did you find it? I say, it was right here. But I think if you restrict yourself and you're afraid of not finding a story, you'll just bring stories with you. You'll do the same story everybody else is doing. You know, pick it out of a newspaper and redo it. And I just didn't want to do that.
In truth, I've learned a lot of lessons from Mike Leonard, folks. But that was the one that I learned from him. The first time I watched one of your features, Mike, I wondered what the hell made this guy decide to tell this story. And when we chatted, you said, Mark, here's one of the credos, if you will, that I live by. If everybody's going to a softball tournament to do a story on the undefeated team, I'm going to find the team that's never won a single game. And that's the story that I want to do. And I built a career on doing exactly that. I never did a story on the star high school quarterback. I always did a story on the star high school quarterback's mother. And, right. It is an interesting way into a story. The thing about you, Mike, is, among many things, is you're a great writer. And I wonder, did you always know that you were a great writer? Because you were a college hockey player. You were not the kind of guy that I think did a lot of writing before you got into TV. Was that a skill you always had and just had to develop?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I was a very poor student, and I didn't know it. I didn't know why at the time, but it turns out that I'm dyslexic. So I had real problems reading. And when I talked, I kind of stumbled all the time because I just didn't know. And I didn't know what the problem was. And so I never got good grades in writing. I didn't think I was a writer. But when I went to Providence in 1966, and I was the first Chicago kid to play Division I hockey, and I was only accepted on academic probation. So, and it was during Vietnam. So the thing is, if you got one F or two Ds, you're going to go to Vietnam probably. So there's a lot of pressure, but I just felt that I could do it. I did make the hockey team. I managed to pass my courses, but I didn't have any money at the time. And my girlfriend, now my wife, was going to school in Milwaukee. Kathy was going to Marquette. And I wrote a letter to her every single day for 4 years. And sometimes it would only be one page. And it was just me not worried about punctuation or grammar, just telling her what was going on in life. And so when I finally got the chance to, you know, try TV as a 31-year-old and they said, do a story, I thought of the letters I wrote and I wanted to tell it more personal way, a more casual way. And then I got confident once they started doing it and people liked it. And then they say, you were really a good writer. And a lot of people have said that if I were a better student, or if people actually tried to get in and say, okay, you need some special education, all the rest, that might not have happened. You know, I think I had to be on the outside, wondering what was going on, why I wasn't passing, why I couldn't raise my hand in class, why I couldn't speak in public. I was terrified. And I had to figure that out. And I slowly came out of that. And that's why I think it took me till I was 31. But I feel very confident. I mean, I could not raise my hand. I don't think I ever did in high school. I can't remember doing it in college. I was afraid to speak. And then I ended up in a job where you're speaking live to 6 million people. And I wasn't afraid. And I think it was just that inch by inch failure. And then you get knocked down or you goof up and you stutter or you stammer on TV and you think, oh my goodness, everybody in the world saw that. And you wake up the next day and you're not dead. And you go, well, it wasn't so bad. And I think a lot of those situations got me to the point where I wasn't then afraid to try something new because I wasn't like the rest. I didn't look like the rest, but my face was beat up by hockey and I wasn't a smooth talker. I wasn't a Bob Costas or anything like that. So I wanted to get into the soul of the story and then soul of the people that I was talking to. And that's why, like you, I would go toward, you know, the center on the football team, the guy who protects the quarterback rather than the quarterback, and get a different perspective. And I want to tell a real quick story. I was at an airport one time in Rhode Island, and a guy recognized me, started talking to me, and he was headed out on a business trip. And I asked him about his life, and he said he was an accountant or something. He said, but I'm also the bullpen catcher for the AAA baseball team in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, the Red Sox farm team, top farm team. I said, oh, really? How long? He said, I've done it for about 8 or 9 years, and it's great, but I'm gonna retire because my kids are getting old and I miss seeing them. And I started thinking about he's retiring from a game that he's never played. He wears a uniform. He's in the bullpen. These guys who are going up to the major leagues or going down from the major leagues or hoping to make the major leagues are warming up, and this guy's catching it. And now he's going to quit that. And it's funny, his name was Joe. He's going to be an average Joe. So no more, hey, I'm Joe, I'm the bullpen catcher. Just, I'm Joe, the dad. And I said, I want to do your story. And he goes, for the Today Show, he goes, on a bullpen catcher? A guy who never plays? I said, exactly. And it was one of my favorite stories. And like many of the people I've profiled, we've become friends. And so and it was Joe Bosio. And I just love the story because most of us aren't headliners. You know, most of the kids, if we have kids, aren't the star quarterbacks. A lot of them ride the bench or don't even make the team. And I gravitate more towards that. And that's the real stuff. That's what life is all about.
You know, Mike, I was trying to explain to someone recently what makes your work special. Someone that, you know, was younger and didn't follow you when you were on the Today Show. And what I found myself saying is that Mike Leonard's work is remarkable in an unremarkable way. I mean, it doesn't scream in a world that now rewards screaming. It's been apparent from the beginning that you don't write to impress. You are clever without being outrageous. It's never look at me. It's always let me celebrate you. It's not about bizarre behavior, which is very easy to report on. It's about your ability, and I think you just nailed it, your ability to make simple, common behavior interesting and inspiring. Is that, in a nutshell, what's made you successful?
That's perfect. And remember one time just musing about things and trying to figure out what to do a story on. And somebody said, oh, any Joe Blow can do this. And I thought to myself, there's got to be somebody out there named Joe Blow. So it was before the internet. And I, you know, you call directory assistance. Yes. And I say, yeah, Joe Blow, anywhere USA. And anyway, I found a guy named Joe Blow, and he was an older man in Texas. And the idea of the story was just a profile on your average human being who happened to have a funny name. So I didn't make fun of Joe. We laughed about it and the predicaments that he would have when he tried to make reservations in a restaurant and things like that. But it was a really cool story to me because it was in praise of all the other Joe Blows out there. And he typically, because he was not a star, he kept saying, I don't know why you're here, man. I don't think I'm that interesting. And I said, oh, you are. And at the very end, after 2 days of hanging with him and him asking me why I'm interested, he goes, I don't know if you'd be interested in this, but I have an old yellowed photograph of me meeting a guy named John Doe. I go, yeah, I want to see that. Anyway, it was a cool story. And I would always make sure that it's too easy, as you know, to go in and kind of make fun of people, right? And then leave, you never see them again, right? And I guess I've been, you know, criticized a lot in my life, and I've gotten used to it in a sense, but it's not fun. And I don't want to be that guy who goes in and does it. So I think it's that sensitivity of, I don't want to leave and have their life be made worse by my presence. And I stuck to that.
Mike Leonard, a good guy and a great storytelling talent. We'll continue our conversation with Mike in just a minute and learn what he thinks about the division in America today. And a little later, you'll meet Mert, the octogenarian adventure seeker who says it's never too late to chase your dreams. And we'll revisit our conversation with the late, great Diane Carroll in a GB flashback classic. This is Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by...
If you or a loved one are over 65 and need a ride, check out Uber. Many Medicare Advantage Flex cards help cover the cost of Uber rides to appointments and important deliveries with Uber Eats like groceries and over-the-counter medication. Learn more at uberhealth.com/card or call 1-866-827-4584. Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. We are talking today with former NBC Today Show feature correspondent Mike Leonard. This is the guy who for decades had the job that everyone in the industry wanted, doing whatever stories he wanted, wherever he wanted, and what he wanted to do was what we need today more than ever. He went from Des Moines to New York City, from San Francisco to Tuscaloosa, and he didn't do stories that divided. He didn't discuss politics. He did stories on our common humanity, our shared dreams. Mike's voice is one we need now more than ever. And as we pick up our interview with Mike, he's sharing his frustration over today's culture of hate and division.
That's why I'm doing it. And I am frustrated. And always, towards the end of my career, you detect that the news business is shifting. And they're going more towards live because they're paying the anchors and the hosts so much that they want them on the kit and on the air all the time. And they seem to lose interest in regular people and those stories that would bind the country together. But I've been in every red and blue state around. And what I am continually frustrated about is that we've been divided by forces who want us to divide. I have great friends in Cajun country, Louisiana, and it's a conservative part of the country. I have great friends in Greenwich Village. That's a liberal part. And we never talk politics. We just talk about life, and they're still my friends. And but I find more and more today that if, let's say, you're a liberal and someone says, do you want to go down to rural Texas with me? People go, no, I don't want to go down there. That's the opposition. And then rural Texas, you say you want to go to San Francisco. We go, no, I don't want to be with those freaks in San Francisco. And they don't know each other. And it's become that. And so I've always thought that the media was really remiss in going for the star treatment, the celebrity treatment, the scandals treatment, and politics 24 hours a day, and not telling the stories about real people. And when you see them, you're inspired by them and they unite us. And, you know, we were talking about this new venture I'm on. You know, my agent was great and I got ownership of my pieces. So I did over 1,000 of them, and they're on everyday people, and they're funny, they're sentimental, they're the whole mix. And they've only been seen once. And so I thought, wow, how do I get them on? I can't convince a TV station to do it. They're just doing politics 24 hours a day. And then this new thing, what's called Substack. It's for writers. It's a email, you know, a thing that comes out. It's a page, it's a platform. And people sign up, and it's for writers, and there's no ads and there's no spam. There's nothing like that. You can write what you want, and you can put video there and you can put pictures there. I have a great amount of material there that's free, and some, because of, you know, the time and work it takes to produce, is under a paywall, but it's cheap. But I feel more creative than I've ever been in my life, which is incredible. I mean, you, the great entree you had today when you opened the show, that why don't we believe that? Well, I don't know why. Other people don't believe in us, and we stop believing in ourselves. But musicians or painters or astronomers, if they love what they do, they're going to do it until they die. And I love being able to pass on this information, write it to connect it to our present day life, add a bit of humor if I need to, show pictures of my life and my family and our ups and downs and our humorous things. And it's really connecting. And what I think it's going to do, of course, will it change everything? No, but it will make a difference, because you will see these people from Louisiana and these people from San Francisco and all these folks sharing in this life that we have. And, you know, it's just maybe one candle in a whole sea of darkness, but it is a candle. And I know that when I look at these old stories myself, I feel hopeful and I feel encouraged. And I do believe that we need more hope and encouragement, but not in a sappy, melodramatic, you know, way, in a real way, and let those voices be heard.
And Mike, one thing I want to ask you about is, I mentioned in the introduction that you were a New York Times bestselling author. Just a fascinating story, and I don't want to tell it. I want you to tell as much of it as you want, but Mike decided, and I've told this story to so many people because I think it just represents not just how clever you are, but you know, what a great family man you are. Mike decided that he wanted to take his aging mom and dad basically on a final lap around America, stopping at every important touch point in their life, the hospitals where their kids were born, the graveyard where one of their children died, their high schools, their colleges, the homes where they got married, all of this. So he put his family, his mom and dad, his family, his kids in an RV, two RVs, and they drove around the country. And as I understand the story, Mike, you told NBC you wanted to do it, and they said, yeah, great, let's make this one of your stories. So Mike produced a series on this that became an iconic series, led to this best-selling book. So I have told it all, Mike, and I apologize. Fill in the blanks and tell me, will you do any of that on your new Substack?
Well, yes. It's been 20 years. And what happened was, originally my dad didn't have much money, and he was in Arizona and living in an apartment that was close to anything. And so my dad's a gregarious guy, and so is my mom, and they couldn't talk to many people, and I felt sorry for them. And I don't know, one night I just had this thought of RVs, and we're not RV people. And I think part of it was to give them mobility, right? To show them, bring them back to places that were important, and show them places they've never seen or will never see again. So we picked them up in Arizona. And also, our oldest daughter was expecting, we were expecting our first grandchild in March. And so I picked them up in January, thinking that we could time it and to be in Chicago when my daughter had her baby. Of course, you can't predict those things. And my wife was going, this is nuts. You're not RV people, and the baby, you don't know what's going to happen. And anyway, there was drama with the baby and some complications, but it all worked out. And And my parents on this trip, I'm one of four boys, but there was, we had an older sister who died when my dad and mom were in the Navy in New London during World War II. And they hardly ever talked about it. And I wanted to bring them back there. But as I got to the graveyard, as we got to New Haven or New London, I kept kind of trying to edge into the conversation, and it seemed like they didn't want to go there yet. So we went to the graveyard ourselves, and I left a daughter-in-law with my parents, and we said we're going to go look at or buy groceries, and we went. And we were looking for the gravestone or a little plaque for this girl, this baby. Couldn't find it. And the graveyard worker was there, and he had a map, and he said, yeah, a lot of these plaques get ripped up by the lawnmower, and they're gone. And so I thought, this little baby is not even a mark that this child lived. And so he took his big stick and he scratched out a square on the grass as the baby's there. Anyway, so we filmed it, and it was part of the four-part Today Show piece that came on. And I thought, I had to call my mom and dad before it aired and say, tomorrow, I didn't tell you, but we went to the graveyard. And so it was emotional for them. But then I decided, my dad got sick after that, got cancer, lost an ear, and I wanted to go back to certain places that, you know, that I wanted to revisit a last time. And so I took my parents on a second trip, and this time it was a train trip and some rental cars, and I had a headstone made, and my mom didn't know that. And so I said, let's go to the graveyard, and she was crying, and I didn't want to film that. And my son was in the back seat with her. Anyway, we go there, and she goes to the grave, and there's this stone, Ann Leonard, you know, one day. And I thought to myself, what did I do that for? Why am I just trying to be a hero? Why did I film that? What's wrong with me? Why did I have to put the camera out there at all? But after it aired on the Today Show, I got so many letters from people, from women, saying, thank you for doing that. I lost a child. And they just expect us to go on, you know? And so I thought, I was honest with myself thinking, am I trying to be this heroic character? And maybe part of me was trying to do that, but it ended up being so, you know, uplifting to people who lost babies. Another thing is too, my dad being, you know, he died at the age of 94. He was 87, I think, when we took the trip. But when he died, they had a big thing on the Today Show about my dad. Like, the guy had no money, right? And he was a salesman. And sorry to say that Jack Leonard died today. And they had clips from the show. And also that piece, that the whole ride of our lives things, I have never in my life had done a story that got the reaction. My mom and dad are funny characters. But there's an element of sentimental, sometimes heartbreak, sometimes joy, sometimes laughter. And it's everybody's story. It sounds like a cliche, but it's everybody's story.
And Mike, help us wrap this up. I get that there really is a moral inside every story that you tell. But that said, you have had a unique front row seat to life. You know, the big events, the small moments. You've known the superstar celebrities, the humble, common man. You've seen the ambition and the fear and the success and the struggle. What have you learned about life? I mean, is there a big moral to the story of life that you've learned over the years?
Sure. I mean, we have way more in common than people give us credit for. We're human beings, people who we can relate just by being kind and being funny. And it is a slog, right? You know, it's ups and downs, and you get knocked down. And I've failed so many times. I think that's why I was not afraid to be creative, because I'd already failed a lot in school and all that. And I'm still alive. I feel so excited at 76 to be this free creatively. And, you know, Mark, I started writing, and I hadn't written that kind of thing in a while. And it started coming back. And my wife goes, you're enjoying this. I said, I really am. It's like a paintbrush back in my hand, or guitar in my hands, or something. And there's a bigger reward at the end of it, because these stories are inspiring, and they inspire me. And I know they will inspire people.
Well, you give us hope, Mike Leonard. Thank you so much. Folks, it is Leonard's Look. And take a look, because you will see the beauty of life. You'll understand the importance of connection, the common threads that bind us all of it, you know, revealing the importance of friendship and the strength of our family ties. Unfortunately, most of it hidden in plain sight that we don't take the time to see. But when you check out Leonard's look, you will see it and you'll begin to celebrate it. And, you know, I think Tom Brokaw said it best when he said, quote, Mike Leonard is a national treasure. Thanks, Mike.
Well, Mark, you are too. And I'm not kidding. What you're doing is terrific and it's encouraging. And you're a warrior for all that is good. So I'm really honored to know you.
Coming up, the legendary actress who became the first African-American woman to star in her own TV series. But first, a visit with Mert Rose, whose lifetime passion for adventure includes everything from wing walking to diving for treasure to becoming a pilot. This is Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. Mert Rose isn't about to change the formula that has led to a life of never-ending adventure. She still flies planes after decades spent jumping out of them and walking on their wings. She's lived in the jungles of Peru, and she's scuba dived for treasure in the Bahamas. As she approaches her 90s, she remains fearless, still pursuing a never-ending hunt for fun and adventure.
Take a dream and go after it, and don't say you can't.
Okay.
Mert Rose has lived a life most people only dream about. If you have it on your bucket list, chances are Mert Rose has already checked it off hers.
You can look at it and say, I never became great at any one thing because I'd be doing something, and then I'd say, well, that looks interesting, more fun. I'm going to do that.
It was her hunt for fun that motivated Mert to jump out of planes in her 20s. She and her first husband, Ted Strong, owned a parachute company, and Mert jumped at least 100 times.
They put you in the door of the airplane, and the wind is just grand. Your feet are sliding sideways, and you do go and you say, what am I doing here? But once you're out, it is the quiet. It's so quiet. And you watch the plane go away and the parachute opens and you're floating. It's a wonderful feeling.
Mert graduated from Endicott College in 1956 and eventually became an art teacher. But her sense of adventure kept Mert from staying in one place too long.
Can't just sit home and be afraid. Can't be afraid.
That lack of fear empowered Mert to strap herself to the wing of an airplane at the age of 40. She went from parachuting out of a plane to standing on top of a plane, performing as a wing walker for the first time during the 1976 Oshkosh Air Show. The biggest surprise? She had never even practiced before the show.
I got there early, he got there late, and you and I aren't allowed to practice the day of the show. So the first time I was ever up on the wing was in the show.
Where did you find the courage? Like, I think that's very courageous. Did you think of that you had to have a lot of courage to do that?
I don't know. I was flying, and I had been adventuresome. I went down to South America and lived with the Indians, where I was scuba diving and finding treasure, and parachuting and flying. And so it was kind of a step, you know. It was fun. I had a great time.
Did anybody try to stop you from being a wing walker?
No. I didn't. I never told my parents until after I sent them newspaper clippings. And I said, this is what I've been doing this summer.
Mert learned to fly both single and multi-engine aircraft, including seaplanes, and received her helicopter rating at the age of 60. Her favorite plane is Winston, an antique Piper J3 Cub, which she still flies today at her homes in Florida and Illinois. Mert and Ted later divorced but remained great friends until his death in 2011. It was at the Oshkosh Air Show in 1985 that Mert met her second husband, Bill Rose. He loved flying in airplanes, and he loved adventure as much as Mert.
He had all these airplanes, and he was a pilot. I mean, he was building, always building something. And he had a great restaurant, big business. We had a very interesting life.
Celebrating birthdays was a big deal to Mert's husband, Bill. So when he turned 70, Mert surprised him by doing a wing walk over their home in Marco Island, Florida. She was 64 at the time.
Every 5 years, he had to have a big birthday party. So when I gave him this, I came in and wing walked, and a reporter said to him, "Well, what do you think she's going to do in 5 years? And he said, "Oh, it is a joke." He said, "Oh, she'll probably come in naked on an elephant." I thought, I can do that.
And that's exactly what she did. For Bill's 75th birthday, Mert rode into his circus-themed party on an elephant. She wore a skin-colored bodysuit with strategically painted sections that gave the crowd and Bill quite a fun surprise. For his 80th birthday, they rode camels at a wildlife preserve in Naples, Florida. In 2010, Bill Rose passed away at the age of 83 following a heart attack. Mert carried on their tradition of flying and often took her Piper J3 out in the afternoons. One afternoon flight made headlines around the world.
I used to fly every afternoon around 5:30, 6 o'clock in that time. So I went out and got in the airplane and went off and did my little tootled around the farms and waved at people and, you know, and coming back, all of a sudden this jet flew by me and I would look like, oh, they must be coming back from Oshkosh. And because there were a lot of jets up there at Oshkosh. Then I started descending. And so all of a sudden, one came over the top of me, and then the other one came by me again. And so I waved. I said, "Oh, they're looking at how cute my airplane is." So I waved. So I was right next to the grass strip when I stopped, and I looked down the runway, and they were coming right down the runway low. And then they went straight up in the air with afterburners going, and right up, and the whole place just shook, you know, how they are. And totally loaded with missiles. I mean, they were totally loaded. And I said, "Oh." And so then 4 state police cars and 4 town police cars came down and surrounded the airplane.
What Mert didn't know was she had flown her antique airplane through then President Obama's restricted airspace, and the Secret Service was not happy. It took 6 months to convince them it was an honest mistake. She avoided reporters until she saw a story on the front page of her local newspaper.
When they put that headlines in the Herald, that elderly woman invades Obama airspace, and put my age, well, that pissed me off. You know, I didn't think that was nice. So I said, "Okay, I'll give an interview." So the next guy who called, it was AP News, and that went all over the world.
Mert says she will keep flying as long as she's able.
Well, if you have a dream, go after it and keep after it. And so you fail once, keep going after it and enjoy your life. Enjoy every day. Tomorrow it might not be there. Just go after life. It's short. You know, you never thought about the end. Now you think about it and you think about what the kind of person you are. And I always hope that I'm kind. But I hope that when I'm 95, I can still be doing something exciting. I don't want to just sit and watch television, play with an iPhone, something like that.
Man, you gotta love her spirit of adventure. Just go after life. Enjoy every day. That's great advice from Mert Rose. And what an inspiration to see somebody in her 80s so passionate about life that she's looking forward to what it might be like in her 90s. Up next, we open the GB Vault to revisit our conversation with the groundbreaking actress Diane Carroll. This is Growing Bolder. We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live. Welcome back to Growing Bolder. The legendary actress Diane Carroll passed away back in 2019 at the age of 84 after a long battle with breast cancer. We interviewed Diane on this program in 2009 when she was about to turn 74. We talked to her about her breast cancer and, of course, about her six-decade career in which she broke through multiple barriers. As the star of Julia, she became the first African-American woman to star in her own TV series. She was nominated for an Emmy for Julia in 1969, and she won the Golden Globe Award in 1968. She became the first Black woman to win a Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical, and she received an Academy Award nomination for her work in the film Claudine. We pick up our conversation with Diane talking about her willingness and ability to confront racism by refusing to play the typical role for Black actresses back in the 60s, that of a domestic worker.
I think that's the easy road. It's not necessarily the most successful road, but it certainly is the easier thing to do. If you feel something is the right thing to do, you have to find out why someone might disagree with you. So you might learn from it. But I've tried to do what I think is the right thing to do.
You know, it just doesn't seem possible now, Diane, but is it really true that you were not invited to the cast party of a Broadway play that you were the star of back then?
Absolutely. What year was that?
It was in the early 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I'm sorry that I don't remember the name of the family that held the cast party, because I would have included it in the book. I don't remember the name. But unfortunately, it was part of the Motor families of Detroit, I think. But it happened, and to tell you the truth, it's still from my mother's philosophy, I was more embarrassed for them than for myself. I didn't doubt for a moment that the entire company would back me up and not choose to attend, and it worked out that way.
Boy, one year we all remember well for many different reasons is 1968, which is the year that Julia hit the air. And America literally fell in love with you. Did you expect that? Were you surprised by that? How was that time in your life?
You know, I started with in-person appearances. And what that really is all about is walking on stage alone, hoping that the audience will respond to you positively and enjoy what it is that you bring for them to hear, to see. So it was not a new area. It's just that we were, of course, on television now, and it was across the country, every millions of people seeing me at once. And when the response was overwhelmingly in our favor as a production, it really made us very, very happy, and that's what you pray for. Today it's the same. You have a television series, you want everyone in the world to say, oh, I must see this new show. So we were very honored.
We're talking, folks, with Diane Carroll, who has written an incredible memoir called The Legs of the Last to Go. And I wanted to ask you, Diane, did you consider not writing the book? Because I know it's opened up parts of your life that you probably would rather keep quiet, but you've been very open about some relationship problems that you have had and some issues that you've had with being a mother and focusing between home and career. Were you considering that when you wrote the book?
You know, there is this philosophy that I came upon, I guess it's 20 years ago now or more, a woman in our profession, Ingrid Bergman was one, and the other women in our profession, Simone Signoret, and they felt that if they didn't write their story, someone else would, and they'd rather have the facts of it correct. You know, I've had many people ask me if my daughter is the product of the relationship with Sidney Poitier and myself, and of course that's absolutely inaccurate, and I didn't want any of those stories to continue. I was hoping that the legs are the last to go would clarify a lot of questions that I found I've not answered through the years, and so I thought it best to write the book and as openly and honestly as I could.
And in the book, do you mention your battle with breast cancer? And if so, how has that affected your life?
I do. I talk about my battle with breast cancer. As a matter of fact, I travel and I speak to women primarily about breast cancer. And it changes your, you know, you really have to face your own mortality when something like that comes into your life. And what it means to you and what it means to your family and your friends as well. I think I've gotten in touch with my humility. I hope I have. I think that's difficult for people in show business, but I hope I have. And also taking much better care of myself. I spend a great deal of time trying to, as they say, stay on top of everything that has to do with breast cancer. And I think I've put my family at ease about the way I feel about it. It happened, and the best thing to do is deal with it as positively as we possibly can. And I've been quite a number of years now, and I'm doing very well, thank you.
Yeah, and look at you, Diane. I mean, I don't know if you talk about it much, but I hope I'm not saying this impolitely, but you're in your mid-70s now.
I have a birthday next month. I'll be 74. Wow.
And look at you. I mean, you're in an industry that chews people up and spits them out all the time just for turning 30, but you've been able to endure, but you know, and not just like an old character actress, but like a real, you know, bombshell. How have you been able to do that?
I haven't any idea. I think it's wonderful that people still come to see me. I don't work that often anymore. I can't really tell you the truth. But I find it's amazing. Women say things to me that they've been saying to me for 45 years. Oh, I love that gown. I came to see the wardrobe as much as I came to hear the music. That's amazing for a 74-year-old woman. So I'm very pleased by it. And maybe the character that I created, Diane Carroll, has had an impact in certain areas. I don't know how profound that is to worry about one's wardrobe, but I've enjoyed it.
Of course, Diane Carroll was far more than her wardrobe. She not only had the talent, but the willingness and the personality to confront racism in a way that made television more inclusive and more accommodating to actors of all races. Diane Carroll was inducted into the Television Academy Hall of Fame in 2011. Well, you don't have to be a barrier-breaking cultural icon like Diane Carroll, and you don't have to be a wing-walking adventure seeker like Mert Rose or an endlessly creative storyteller like Mike Leonard. Most of us aren't any of those things. But what we can all learn from them is the importance of belief in ourselves, the value of never giving up, the power of curiosity. Because when you strip everything else away, all of their stories, their lives, their successes have been driven by curiosity, by the habit of choosing curiosity over fear, by a willingness to continue growing bolder. And before we go, did you know that Growing Bolder is also available as a podcast on NPR One, Apple, Spotify, and Google? Do me a favor. Make sure to subscribe and tell all of your friends because we are all in this together. And check out our new streaming platform at watch.growingbolder.com. It's filled with videos of hope, inspiration, and possibility available 24/7 at no cost. Thanks for listening and being part of the Growing Bolder movement.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved.
This program was recorded at Growing Boulder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tap through my ears, flowing high and mighty trapped. Countless fires.